I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The news of the Big Bang is this visible proof out of Harvard and MIT that what we thought happened, happened. It was cosmic inflation, after all, an almost infinite build-out in a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second that launched our fluid, expanding universe. All the dark energy, black holes, anti-gravity, antimatter, and our own cozy galaxy tucked in among hundreds of billions more. So here are 10 questions we could ask science to work on. What's driving this thing? Where is it going? What is it made of? What does it mean? Where do we come in the last few blinks of universal time? What if we hadn't come in at all? What's it for? What would make it good? And what would move you to call it beautiful? And how will it end? It was Albert Einstein who said, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible." And that's pretty much what kids testified to our open source producer Max Larkin on Cambridge Common this week.
100 years ago, there was a dinosaur who...
No, there was this meteorite that... as big as, like, a small town, and it hit the Earth, and then, like...
There were some cavemen, and then...
People think monkeys, some people think God, I don't know.
I forget what it's called, the Milky Way.
But what came before the Milky Way?
Meteors?
No, there was nothing.
Do you know what the Big Bang is?
No. Like, the starting of the universe, like... There's like a blah, blah, and the universe started or something.
What do you think happens at the end of the universe?
There's an end? I don't know.
You don't know?
Meter.
How about him?
Meter.
There's an end and it grows bigger every second. A seventh grader told me. I think there will be an end, and after that, I think like everything that already happened will like happen again and then again and again.
Sometimes I think it's God's dream.
I think this all is nothing.
This spring of 2014 is already a time to be remembered, probably at the Nobel Prize level, for breakthroughs and affirmations in the human understanding of how our world began, something like 14 billion years ago. The mission this hour is to get into scientific heads and language and evidence about what happened. We're trying to give our own venerable creation myths, religious and otherwise, a rest. And we want to push our guests for creation myths of their own. How much data from a Hubble telescope does it take to tell us a story? Three eminent guests join us in the studio with three different roles. Robert Kirschner is our watcher at the observatory, specifically the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge. Max Tegmark of MIT is a mathematician and a writer. He's our interpreter of the microwave echoes still pulsing out there with Big Bang vibrations. And Alan Guth is our thinker. I remember, Alan, how that we talked about this on the radio almost 20 years ago about an idea you were hatching about cosmic inflation. Our phone is 800-423-8255. The cosmologists are in this hour. We're hoping they've got the answers to some very big questions. Ask your own at 800-423-TALK. Alan Guth, we've had it on our website all today, this notebook entry, your own, from December 1979. You wrote spectacular realization about this idea of cosmic inflation. And now it's confirmed. What were you thinking about when you not just wrote spectacular realization, but you wrote a sort of double border around it, like bingo?
I was very excited when I realized this. I had been working on cosmology for almost a year until that time, and all kinds of things happened that allowed things to fall into place. There were really a number of lucky coincidences of pieces of information just happening to fall into my lap. But then in one night, I realized that a certain idea that a colleague and I were pursuing together would lead to exponential expansion of the very early universe. And I realized immediately that that would solve a very important problem in cosmology that I had learned about, something called the flatness problem, which is basically the problem that in order to make the early universe work, in order to make the early universe lead to what we now see, the expansion rate at 1 second after the Big Bang had to be just what we thought it was to an accuracy of 15 decimal places, a little more, and the universe would just fly apart without anything forming structure. A slightly slower expansion rate, the universe would have rapidly recollapsed with nothing happening. And at this point, it was a mystery what caused this exactly this expansion rate. And it turned out that this idea of inflation led exactly to the right expansion rate.
Vastly faster than the speed of light. To begin with.
I should maybe clarify, though. It's the size of the universe as a whole that's expanding faster than the speed of light. And that's allowed by general relativity because we think of it as the space in between stretching. And general relativity places no limit on how fast space can stretch.
So the New York Times readers, like me, come to think of it as sort of this kind of bowl or this rather small amount of unbelievably hot soup being transformed into infinite space. Some, you know, the unimaginably huge from the unimaginably small in the unimaginably short time.
Yeah, well, that's what you said is almost true, except at the end, it's not really unimaginably large. The region that's going to become what today is our visible universe starts out before inflation more than a billion times smaller than the size of a proton. But at the end of inflation, it's not huge. It's really only about the size of a marble or so.
I want to be bold, and I wouldn't have even asked this question except that John Updike sort of put the objection in this wonderful book of Jim Holt's called Why Does the World Exist? And this is the way he put it in conversation on the phone. He said, the whole idea of inflationary expansion seems sort of put forward on a smile and a shoeshine. Granted, it solves a number of cosmological problems that were embarrassing, but the notion, this is Updike, that this planet and all the stars we see, many thousands of times more than those we see, that all this was once bounded in a point with the size of what? A period or a grape. How, I ask myself, could that possibly be? And that said, I sort of move on. And your answer is, I mean, you might well say today, well, John, you should see the pictures. You should see the evidence.
Exactly.
Could you convince him?
I would hope so.
You can't trust common sense.
Bob Kirshner.
You can't trust common sense. John Updike has grown up on Earth, I think, although he writes divinely. He has grown up on Earth. He played baseball and he watched baseballs arc through the air and he caught them. And that's what he knows about physics. But the physics that Alan is talking about is a physics that is not part of your everyday experience. It's not part of common sense. It's part of the microscopic physics that people have developed to understand the quantum world and the particle world. Alan was a particle physicist, and he brought new ideas to the astronomical world.
But he's also there calculating, how do we get from here to there in a very limited amount of time? Well, we could just multiply the damn thing, you know, bang.
Oh, he's not that cynical.
No, I don't mean cynical, but you know what Updike's saying is this is too convenient. It just works too well.
That's not Alan's method of operation. He's not trying. He just wanted to solve a really big problem. Why is the universe nearly flat? Which, as a matter of fact,
who says it is?
If you had asked me in 1980, I would have said, Alan, it's not one in those units. It's 0.3. But it turned out.
But wait a second. Who looks at the stars and says we've got a flat universe here?
Well, flat means the geometry of Euclid.
We have
go ahead.
We have to remember also that when Alan made this calculation and said, here's our theory of inflation, this is not a theory in the sense of just some verbose blah, blah, blah. This is a rigorous set of mathematical equations based on the best physics experiments we have previously, where you simply calculate something and you see what comes out. In this case, what came out was an extremely audacious prediction, right? Because what we just heard Alan say here was you start with a tiny speck smaller than a proton and you just keep doubling its size over and over again. And so he's saying basically that our baby universe is very much like baby Alan Guth, because he started out being one cell, then he was two cells, four, yep. eight, 16, 32, etc. Now, fortunately for his mom, he didn't keep doubling for 9 months of gestation, because then he would have had more mass than our whole universe after, before birth. But what Alan's theory is saying is the same thing happened to our universe, exactly. Kept doubling at least 80 times, and then it slowed this crazy doubling, except it did it much faster. Alan doubled once every day when he was a fetus. He says our universe doubled once every hundredth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second. And then as Bob Kirshner said so correctly here, we can't just use traditional intuition to say, oh, this sounds weird, I'm going to dismiss it. It's a prediction.
And we want to get into your heads. So you this go is the whole point. The
extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that's why we're here tonight, because extraordinary evidence has been found.
Yeah, talk about the evidence. This is partly Hubble telescope as well as, you know, mathematical calculation. What could we see tonight that we couldn't see even 6 weeks ago?
So this was a very violent thing, obviously, doubling the size of space over and over again so rapidly. And it was so violent that it actually did something very violent to the very fabric of space itself. It put ripples in it that we know as gravitational waves, huge ones to the tune of a billion light years long. And this incredibly heroic team spent years at the South Pole, you know, freezing their posteriors off at 100 Fahrenheit minus temperatures, and were able to actually see in the sky the imprints of these gravitational waves.
What do they look like?
Oh, they look like little swirls, right?
Right.
There are diagrams of these things, and they look like kind of donuts or something. There's a pattern in the sky which is telling you that something really interesting happened early on and that gravity played a role. So the highbrow way to talk about this is to analyze the pattern in the microwave sky. And this is what people have done at great effort, going to the South Pole, because they believed it was worthwhile to test these ideas. That's the thing that's so audacious. I mean, you know, going to the South Pole is not like traveling to Chile and staying up all night, which I do as an astronomer. I think of myself as a tough guy.
So do
this
we,
is
Bob.
Much harder.
This is something less in the sky, in the night sky, than Aurora Borealis or something. Yeah. But it's something bigger. Well, it's big enough to still be pulsing in this microwave echo, what, 14 billion years later. This is open source on the Big Bang news. The confirmation by observation of our guest Alan Guth's theory of a transformation some 14 billion years ago of, as I was saying, a little hot soup into a vast universe in an infinitesimally brief moment. Max Tegmark, for me, the first trick here is realizing that there's a story with no human interest, shall we say, none of the human categories that we people never stop seeing in things. The physicist Stephen Hawking is making a sort of cosmological joke on that point right here.
My interest in the origin and fate of the universe was reawakened when I attended a conference on cosmology in the Vatican. Afterwards, we were granted an audience with the Pope. He told us that it was all right to study the evolution of the universe after the Big Bang, but we should not inquire into the Big Bang itself, because that was the moment of creation, and therefore, the work of God. I was glad that he did not know the subject of the talk I had just given. The possibility that the universe had no beginning, no moment of creation.
That was the simulated voice of the physicist Stephen Hawking. Back to you, Max Tegmark. Take the question entirely out of this whole human and usually religious zone of contention. Take us out to where it really happened.
First of all, there's a very persistent misconception we really need to shake off now, where we equate our Big Bang with the beginning. We have to stop doing that right now, because what the theory of inflation actually does is it provides an explanation for what caused our Big Bang. At the very earliest stages of inflation, there was nothing very big and nothing that was very bang. You had this puny region, as we heard, vastly smaller than an atom, and it was expanding dramatically slower than it did later. It's just that, like, before a bomb has exploded, there's not much of a bang. Inflation provides this explosive power and makes the bang. I like to think of inflation in its earliest stages as a cold little swoosh, which later creates this hot big bang, which then continued to grow and mature into this star-spangled universe that we inhabit today, with its galaxies and stars and planets and so on. And we humans don't know the answers to some questions. And now we can ask, what started inflation? And this is something I think we can even stump you with, Alan. But
stump the bandit there.
That's true. We don't really know what happened before inflation. We don't really know exactly what started inflation.
But we know what happened before the Big Bang.
The beauty is that once inflation starts, it takes over. And what happens afterward really does not depend at all on what happened before.
So, okay, but let me ask the
really concrete
question.
Okay,
Bob Kirshner.
Well, that's fair enough. But, you know, we only have Stephen Hawking quoting the Pope. But you should not – I don't think it's a wise thing to say, oh, you can't know about the earlier phase. People used to say, well, you can't know about what caused the Big Bang. Maybe now we think, well, we have a little more idea about what caused the Big Bang with this inflation thing. And it's not right to say, oh, you'll never know what came before that, because, you know – we don't have very many clues at the moment, but there's human imagination. That's the part I wanted to say. You said, oh, humans have no role in this. Well, that's true in the sense that there was nobody there. But the humans who have a role in this are the people now puzzling it out. And John Kovach and the people who've labored going to the South Pole in this heroic effort and making these incredible measurements – they are following a set of ideas that were invented by Alan and other people that they've taken seriously.
No, it's a
which
heroic
is
undertaking. You make me want to be a cosmologist.
I'm not sure you want to stay at the South Pole all winter, but anyway.
No. It's a heroic thing. But we're still not in it. I did my own little calculation.
Right.
If you imagine the history of from the Big Bang till today.
Yeah.
Imagine it on a century time scale. So the Big Bang happens with the start of World War One.
Yeah, when Einstein invented general relativity.
Exactly. Okay, that's a part of the point. If it's happening over a century, human beings, Homo sapiens, enters the picture this morning, 12 hours ago. And 20th century science, as you're just speaking about, the whole notion of a non-static universe, that took the stage 20 seconds ago. All this has been going on. It's heroic for people to understand it, but it's been going on without any help from our kind of thing forever.
I think a lot of people seem to get depressed about the fact that we've been on the scene for such a short time and they were so small. I see it the opposite way. I see it the other way around. I think this is a really optimistic thing, you know, because we humans have learned that we're the masters of underestimation. We have again and again and again underestimated not only the size of our cosmos, discovering that everything we thought existed, it was just a small part of a much grander structure, a planet, a solar system, a galaxy, a universe, and maybe even a hierarchy of parallel universes. But we've also discovered, we've also repeatedly underestimated the power, as Bob said here, of our human minds to understand our cosmos. And this discovery here, I think, is the most spectacular example of that ever. Who would have thought that we little earthlings on this little spinning ball in this little galaxy, whippersnappers, newcomers in the universe, right, would be able to figure out what happened 13.8 billion years ago when when our universe was doubling its size in a hundredth of a billionth of a second.
Totally for that sort of celebration, even of our imagination, our curiosity. But we also look at this thing and have to say, first of all, it wasn't driven by anything we know. It's not about sexual desire or love or hate or hunger.
It's not about us.
Yeah, exactly.
The but universe is not about us.
So yeah, what's driving
science, I would still say science is about our curiosity.
But science?
And I would say that curiosity is about as strong a drive as sex and power. Who knows?
But so, instead of.
But it, even though we shouldn't say that our universe revolves around us and get super arrogant about it, I think we should at the same time acknowledge that size is not everything. You know, sorry to put all these sex references here, but we have, we humans may be much smaller than the Milky Way galaxy or the Andromeda, but what are the most interesting and complex things about our universe? The most complex objects we've yet discovered are the human brains. And I think we shouldn't look to our universe as giving meaning to us. It's, we are, in a sense, giving meaning to our universe. If there were no conscious beings in this cosmos, it would just be a giant waste of space, as far as I'm concerned.
What's it got to do with us at all?
Well, but yes,
I think it means we should get our act together and not blow ourselves up.
Well, that seems like a good idea for other reasons, in my opinion.
What if the human species had not come into it at all?
Yeah. I mean, so the same universe.
That's a bottom line question. But here's another way of asking a civilian question. If this is a startup universe, as we're picturing it, why shouldn't there be many, many more? Why couldn't there be another one tomorrow? Reading you guys, your both books and articles on this, I'm more and more persuaded on the Fermi paradox, this question of extraterrestrial life and intelligence. If these things are, shall we say, that easy to get up overnight, shouldn't there be all kinds of them? There are billions and billions and billions of places where what we think of as life could be sustained. What about it?
Alan's been worried about this for a long time. He's been worried about these little budding off universes. Why don't you say
that? That's right. Well, certainly if inflation is right, and there now seems to be very strong evidence that it very likely is right, all inflationary models have the property that inflation becomes eternal, which means simply once inflation starts, it doesn't stop. It stops in places, and we would be living in one of those places where it stopped, and that would form what we sometimes call in this context a pocket universe. Mm-hmm. We'd be living in a pocket universe. But meanwhile, the space around it goes on exponentially expanding literally forever with different pieces of it, producing more and more of these pocket universes ad infinitum. And that certainly seems like a very plausible picture in the context of any inflationary model.
Well, yeah. I mean, as you said,
Max Tegmark, please.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the book I just wrote, I talk about different kinds of parallel universes because it's turned out that it's been very hard for us humans to come up with any kind of theory that just predicts only that which we see and nothing else. So if you want to be an ostrich and stick your head in the sand and insist that there can't be anything beyond what we see, it's very hard for us to make that work within the context of physics. So Alan Guth has given us this mechanism, inflation, which is a universe creation machine, right? If you build a paperclip creation machine, it'll tend to make more than one paperclip. It just keeps cranking them out. And it's the same, in the same way, if you have a mechanism that makes universes, it's pretty natural for it to make many. And that is indeed what inflation...
Well, yes,
I like metaphors, but I don't think paperclip and universe ought to be in the same bucket.
But wait a minute. In biology, we're at least getting used to the notion that there was no single creation of something as complex as the eyeball, for example. That there have been many starts at what became the eye in different species, different places, et cetera. And I suppose if we waited long enough, there would be another evolution of an eyeball. Similarly, in the planetary range, if it can happen overnight on the Alan Guth scheme, it's got to be happening elsewhere.
It's very. If you do the math, then
yes,
indeed. If space is so as big as Alan is saying, you're going to have infinitely many planets in it, and even if the probability is puny that you create a planet that looks just like Earth, which has people like us on it, the probability ain't zero because it happened here. So it'll happen again, and you can figure out how far away you have to go to find the nearest identical copy of our universe. It's about a little over a Googleplex yards, where that's one with a Google zeros, and a Google is one with 100 zeros. So, you know, so it's a long way, but
yards,
it's
not meters, right?
Turns but out look, it comes out in the wash.
You don't but, have to rely on that kind of argument, although it's a fine thing to do, because we can look for planets around other stars in our galaxy. We're not talking about life yet. We're just talking about, right, do you have a planet someplace where the temperature is okay so that molecules can maybe stick together without getting ripped apart? Maybe there's water, all that kind of stuff. And what's happened over the same time period where we've had this cosmological revolution is that we've also learned that there are stars with planets around them, solar systems equivalent to ours, different from ours in ways that we didn't quite understand and didn't imagine properly. But anyway, the possibilities that Max is talking about are not just Max waving his hands, although I noticed he was waving his hands. Hard to see on the radio. But in fact, there are planets around other stars, and the number of stars is something we can count, and it's really big. It's in this class of very large numbers where even something that's extremely improbable probably did happen.
I want to take another stab at sort of seeing it your way and sort of filtering out as much as we can of the sort of human prejudices, but very specifically, a kind of scientific moral question. When you look at this whole epic, what do you see that you're A, inclined to call good? Wow, that's good. It survived or something. And then, more complicated, when you look at the whole story, what makes you say, wow, that's beautiful?
To me, I think the most beautiful and remarkable thing about our cosmos is that you can start with something so simple that obeys Alan Guth's equations, and it grows all by itself into this structure which is so complex.
But Alan Guth's equations are the human piece. What about the
we didn't make them up. Alan didn't make them up. He discovered them. This
well,
is the
that's
one.
A thought.
But we had this these particles moving around according to the laws of physics, and yet out of that great simplicity, obeying these simple laws, came this incredible complexity which even became consciously aware of itself. I think it's one of the most beautiful things we've ever learned, that you can take, that you can actually get a bunch of particles and get them aware of them, self-aware, and feel love and feel the flavor of chocolate ice cream. That's a pretty remarkable thing, that we are in a sense our universe now, you know, becoming aware of itself and even starting to ask these big questions about where it all came from.
Yeah, but the things that we love about looking at the universe are the actual things. You know, those images from the Hubble Space Telescope that you alluded to earlier, those are really interesting images of the world that we live in. And the fact that we like them and that somehow this is something that appeals to our aesthetic sense might be something a little bit deeper.
Again, that's about our aesthetic sense. What about its aesthetic sense?
Oh, no.
It's aesthetic rationale.
No, it doesn't have. No, it's just the laws of physics. I'm sorry, sir. But we like it. We like it when things have symmetry or they have a kind of pattern to them. Then there are a lot of astronomical things which, following the laws of physics, produce things that seem extremely beautiful to us. A planetary nebula with its kind of colors and so on. We love that stuff.
From cosmology to morphology, where do you see the beauty, Alan Guth?
Well, to me, the beauty is the amazing success of mathematics and logic. I find it absolutely amazing that in the 1980s, I and my fellow particle physicists can come up with crazy ideas about how we think the universe acted at a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the beginning, and we could calculate the consequences of those crazy ideas. And within our lifetimes, people start measuring them, and they work. I find that totally amazing.
There are stages of history in all of this, you know, quarks in different eras, and not just of human discovery, but the universe itself went through an evolution. Do you guys ever follow a sort of perils of Pauline? The thing's in trouble. The thing's confused. The thing is going out of control. The thing is getting it together again. I mean, can you read it as a history Well, a dramatic history.
Sure. Yeah. There's a literal history, which is enabled by our new technology, which allows us to see what happened. Because the light travels to us at the speed of light. On the Earth, we think, oh, that's very fast. You know, a foot, that's a unit of distance used in the United States and in Myanmar. A foot in a nanosecond. And we, you know, ordinary distances, very short. But for astronomical distances, that's we see light from the past. We only see light from the past. We see, you go out tonight, if you see stars, the light left them 100 years ago. You see a galaxy, it's a million years. With a big telescope, you can see a billion years into the past, or even 10 billion. That means this story that we've been talking about of 14 billion years of cosmic evolution is not based on just waving our hands. We actually see the light from these ancient objects. We know what happened back then. And we can see that this evolution, which sounds so kind of strange and remote, is actually something that we can observe.
Evolution, I mean, does this thing have a goal? Is it in peril? Must it go on forever? Must it keep expanding? Could it end?
Well, this is a pretty interesting question because there's a certain combination that we have now of dark matter and dark energy, both things that are kind of mysterious. But the fate of the universe depends on the balance between them.
We got to talk more about that. That's your business, Bob Kirshner, dark matter, dark energy, a career following things that we know from the beginning we're not going to be able to see.
Yes. I have a tremendous capacity for illusion.
We're talking about the Big Bang with three extraordinary scientists, Max Tegmark, Bob Kirshner, and Alan Guth, whose theory of a cosmic inflation has been confirmed. This is open source. Here is the famous physicist and teacher Richard Feynman resisting the impulse to grasp the universe in story form.
I can live with doubt and uncertainty and not knowing. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong. I have approximate answers and possible beliefs and different degrees of certainty about different things, but I'm not absolutely sure of anything. And there are many things I don't know anything about, such as whether it means anything to ask why we're here. But I don't have to know an answer. I don't feel frightened by not knowing things, by being lost in the mysterious universe without having any purpose, which is the way it really is, as far as I can tell, possibly. It doesn't frighten me.
That's Richard Feynman. But we're not all Richard Feynman. I mean, he can live with doubt in a kind of infinite inquiry. But most of us want a story. I mean, we are a pattern-seeking species. We long to know where we came from and where we're going. And I'm not sure we can say we deserve it, but I think we want a story from you guys.
I love Richard Feynman. He is actually the person who inspired me to go into physics in the first place through his, through his books. And although all three of us here clearly question all our assumptions all the time and will never bet 100% of our money on any particular claim, at the same time, we love mysteries. I really obsessive about mysteries, and it was that realization that got me into physics. I used to think physics was my most boring subject in high school until I realized, hey, it's just like the detective novels, except better, because we get to be part of trying to solve the mystery. And I think we have again and again made the mistake of shying away from certain questions just because they seemed a little bit too audacious. You'd be like, nah, let's not try to extrapolate too much from known physics because it's probably wrong. We can't possibly understand where our Big Bang came from. And I think I will just counter that by saying, to me, the reason I am so excited about getting to do physics is because nothing to me is off limits. There is no question that I'm not allowed to ask. And I think the best way to fail in science or anything is to convince yourself from the get-go that I can never understand this and therefore not try. And we see here, I think, a celebration really of the most audacious attempt ever to explain something people thought was impossible, make a prediction, and boom, you know, it worked.
I want to encourage you to be bold, each one of you, in your own individual ways, and tell us a story, not a human story, but a story that even from a humanistic standpoint, informs us about ourselves in proportion to what you see. In other words, what we fear about science and the put down about science is it's reductionist. It takes the drama out of life, takes the meaning, takes the human being out. I think probably just the opposite. What you're showing us about infinite space and time is hugely instructive, not only about where we come in, but how we ought to use our time, how we ought to use our moment, what's valuable, what will be memorable, how to be happier, literally, with an understanding of the big picture. Bob Kirshner.
Well, sure. I mean, you live in a world where people are getting Twitter feeds about Justin Bieber's driving habits. I mean,
thank you.
Why are people so interested in that stuff? I don't really know. But the fact is, in the parallel with that sort of busy, noisy world that we're all kind of engaged in, there's this other thing, which is this pursuit of the big questions, which you asked, where are we? Where are we going?
Right.
You know, what time is it? When do we get there? There's all the questions that you get from the back seat when you're driving in a car with kids. It's the same things, only this is a much more sophisticated way of trying to answer it.
But sometimes I think the scientists are your own or our own worst enemy. When I hear somebody like the giant mind of Steven Feinberg say, well, when you know what I know about this whole thing, it's very boring. There's nothing going on. It's just a bunch of stuff.
Look.
And I want to say, no.
The kids in my course come in thinking that science is like a big encyclopedia. And I know a lot more about it than they do, and that's the way it is. But what the truth is that science is like a burning flame. You know, there's a kind of a pursuit, and there's an edge of understanding and ignorance. And, you know, Alan is right on the boundary between understanding and ignorance. He's taken something
Alan
that was a mystery,
yep,
and he's tried out an idea. This one seems to have worked pretty well.
Can you say, Alan, how it instructs your life? I want you to.
Okay. Well, to me, the exciting thing about science is the drive to know. And the amazing thing is that it works, that we can really write down theories and compare them with what we actually see in the real world. And amazingly, we actually have the power to construct theories that describe what the real world does. And I find that just fantastic.
You've shaken your Justin Bieber habit.
Yes.
Oh, he doesn't have one.
No, but
a lot of us concentrate.
I think people are dying to shake their trivia habits. The phone is 800-423-8255. We're talking about the Big Bang as deep down a kind of story, a story for all of us. Joe is calling from Boston. Joe,
hi.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Stump these guys.
Well, something that you were saying earlier in the conversation about the larger story, about the human's role in the creation of the universe and where we fit. And one of the things that just kind of came to mind, I'm a pretty visual thinker in general. I'm clearly not a scientist, but it's definitely something that brings images to my mind. And the first thing I really see is a kind of a fractal, like Mandelbaum and Julia said, where towards the center you see this moment of creation, and then on the fringe, the closer you zoom in and the more iterations, if you just take that same concept and apply it to the model of the universe, it kind of explains, at least for me, where we fit and where we're from. And even to now, looking at human society as just a bunch of particles bouncing into each other, interacting, binding, and affecting one another and causing influence, and maybe not through just mass alone, but through mind, through our ideas and through our imagination. You were talking about Justin Bieber before. And I don't really get into his music, but I'm sure there's other particles.
He doesn't either,
around.
Don't worry.
Yeah.
That was a snotty comment.
Excuse me. But there's an essential point here which seems really good, which is that the universe has become more elaborate over time. So you start with a very simple, hot, dense universe and some particles and so on, with very slight imperfections, very slight density fluctuations from one place to another. And those have grown over time. Gravity acts to make contrast grow. The dense places get denser. The lower density places lose out. Sorry, it's unfair, but that's the way it is. And what has happened, which is so interesting, is that matter has formed into stars. Stars ignite nuclear fusion. That creates heavier elements. Those are blasted back into the gas between the stars. They become the material for the new generation of stars and planets, and including human beings. So you're made of the stuff that used to be in an earlier generation of stars. The iron that's in your blood, the calcium that's in your bones, the oxygen that you're breathing. Those are literally atoms from this elaborating, getting more complicated universe. So there is something interesting happening over time. The universe is getting more interesting.
That's a story indeed. It's exactly where I want my own reading and thinking to go. In other words, it's generally assumed that, you know, it was a terrible defeat for human beings to discover that they weren't the captains of the whole ship. No, it shouldn't be a defeat at all. To see ourselves in a bigger context, even in traditional, you know, understanding of humility, proportion, seeing us in the real context, this is very ennobling. This is very instructive, very valuable.
And I find this pessimism so misplaced when people complain, oh, I'm so depressed that we found out that our cosmos is bigger than we thought. Hey, suppose I was shipwrecked in the middle of the night and I woke up the next morning. What would I prefer to discover? That I'm stuck on some stupid little reef 10 yards across, or that I'm in this on this vast island with all this opportunity? That's what we humans have found. There's so much more opportunity for the future of life. We have 10 to the power of 57 times more volume out there and billions of years at our disposal if we get our act together. To me, this is it's not a bad thing. This is a wonderful thing.
Why should we feel diminished by that?
Well, we shouldn't feel diminished by that. We are part of the whole story. We're not apart from it. We're a part of it. You know, the things that have happened in the past in the universe, even the most abstract things, gravitation, mm-hmm. how much dark energy there is, all of that stuff has balanced out in a way that's produced galaxies, stars, planets, and yeah, people too. So, you know, we're all part of this thing that has a kind of, that we've understood better in the last few months.
How would we walk differently, talk differently, make friends differently with this kind of understanding, Bob?
Well, I'm not sure, but I think this is a good thing to pay attention to and to learn about, because it does. I don't know. It makes me feel better. How about you? Does it make you feel better?
I think it should make us all walk with a slightly straighter posture, feeling a bit more empowered, frankly, because with this with this deeper understanding that we have also comes a power to improve our lot. Why did we get all this technology that helps us live longer and fuller lives now? It came from science in the past. And if we can get our act together as humans and use this technology for good, there is no law of physics saying that life has to be forever confined to our little planet. There is incredible future potential, if you want to think big, for life in our cosmos. And I think it's completely misplaced for us to start saying, oh, now we feel so powerless and small, you know.
Well, you better hurry up, because you've only got about 5 billion years before the sun becomes a red giant. You know this. And then all the lobsters in all the oceans are going to be boiled. It's going to be a problem.
We can move Earth out into this slightly larger orbit with asteroid gravitational tugs. And
behave ourselves better.
Yeah, I'm more worried about us humans doing stupid things to life long before then. Bob.
Exactly. What about stupid things? Alan Guth, we need more of your vision here. But what would this understanding do to our sense of suffering, getting that in proportion, our sense of conflict, our sense of politics, warfare? I mean, I think this could be very calming, very seductive, very ennobling, very challenging to think, wait a sec, guys.
Well, I think that's right. I think science really is a spectacular success of human endeavors. And I think it should give us confidence in ourselves, confidence in human intellect. And I think if more people felt that sense of confidence in human intellect, we could perhaps develop political systems that actually work and that actually reflect the goals of humanity.
And hopefully this sense of confidence will also encourage more kids to want to actually study science in school and help improve our situation in the future.
What's the next question, or the question, shall we say, for the next generation that's as interesting as these?
Oh, man. We're just trying to do the thing that's in front of our noses, you know? And it's very hard to predict accurately what would happen on the generational timescale. That is really a hard problem. You know, at the beginning of the 1900s, there was a kind of thought that maybe physics was dried up because they had solved all the problems except for those damn X-rays, you know? And they probably had something to do with, I don't know, they didn't know. But the idea that there was a subatomic world and that there was a whole quantum mechanical world, that was not on the horizon before 1900. And so you don't want to be too bold or stupid to say what the knowledge will be 50 years from now. What we can say is that the set of questions that we've posed for ourselves, which you put out very well, you know, how did the universe change over time? How did we get where we are? How old is it? What's in it? All that stuff. We've done really well on that. But it doesn't mean that we're done by any means.
I agree.
Yeah, I think we could maybe emphasize somewhat what questions remain unanswered in cosmology, which is the subject we've mainly been talking about. Inflation, if it's right, and it seems to be, takes us back to a billionth of a trillion, well, a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, let's say.
You've learned to say that.
I'm getting used to it. But inflation is not the story of the ultimate beginning. We should emphasize that.
Right.
Inflation does not say how it all started. We don't know that. So that's a big mystery. And another big mystery is if this idea of eternal inflation is valid, which is a reasonable chance it is, we have a whole multiverse to think about. And there are many features of this multiverse that we have no understanding of. And it's not irrelevant. People sometimes think, well, if there are all these other universes out there, who cares? What does it have to do with us?
But can I just say, I didn't know what you were going to say, but you've fulfilled my hope. There's a lot to work with here in terms of a realistic humility about who we are, and also a kind of, as you're saying, should we say, a constructive confidence about what the human mind and human activity, human cooperation, human enterprise, human appetite for understanding can accomplish.
Yeah, and I think the big questions which Alan just raised and the big questions we've been discussing this hour also should encourage us to think big and not be so obsessed about what's going to happen in the next election cycle that we lose track of the longer-term challenges we face. Because, let's face it, we have these incredible opportunities and we should seize them as a species.
I want to quote Stephen Hawking again on the way out because I think this is sort of our consensus. He says, "We are just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet of a very average star, but we can understand the universe. That makes us something very special." Thank you, Alan Guth, Max Tegmark, Robert Kirshner. We're so glad a meteorite didn't hit the studio while the three of you were here with us. We're going out on Watcher of the Skies by the band Genesis. Listeners, you can continue the conversation about the Big Bang. You can add questions and answers and creation myths of your own at our website, radioopensource.org. where there are other conversations and happenings to join as you will. Congratulations to our friend Megan Marshall, who won a Pulitzer Prize this week for her biography of Margaret Fuller. You can hear our conversation with Megan about Margaret and the rest of the Concord Transcendentalists at our website, radioopensource.org. Next week, the irresistible Gustav Mahler with the irresistible conductor Ben Zander. Our show was produced by Max Larkin, Kunal Jasti, and our engineer George Hicks, who suggested this show on the Big Bang. Mary McGrath is the author of Our Universe. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.